Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Midwest Hemp Council Weekly Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Dozier. This week's podcast is brought to you by Lewis Organics and owners Jason and Rachel Kidwell. You can find Lewis Organics on Facebook at Lewis Organics. On this week's podcast, we'll talk with Associate Policy Director for the Indiana Farm Bureau, Jeff Cummins. Jeff, great to have you on the program this week.
Well, it's great to be with you. I'm excited to talk to your listeners today about some of the things going on with Indiana Farm Bureau.
Well, Jeff, tell us a little bit about the Indiana Farm Bureau and, more importantly, how the Indiana Farm Bureau got involved in the hemp industry.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, the mission of Indiana Farm Bureau is to promote agriculture through public education, member engagement, and by advocating for agricultural and rural needs. And of course, when hemp was a crop back years ago, and once again here today, that's an ag and rural need that we've been working on for some time. And so it fits right in with some of our guiding principles about working for farmers in rural communities, and especially advancing new crop opportunities for those folks. So we're excited to be part of the hemp conversation, to see the progress that's made both at the state and federal level. And then there'll be some discussion this legislative session and hopefully in the next Congress when they convene on those kinds of things, on hemp and the future of the industry.
And Jeff, how long have you been with the Indiana Farm Bureau?
I just crested the one-year mark about a month ago. And before that, I was the council and legislative director with the Indiana State Department of Agriculture, where we worked on quite a few ag policy issues, including hemp. We were not, as an agency, out front, tip of the spear on getting the hemp law passed, but has certainly spent a lot of time collaborating with folks, state chemists, Midwest Hemp Council, and the governor's team on getting that bill passed a couple of years ago.
All right. So you've been with the Indiana Farm Bureau for a little over a year. So when you came in, there was no conversation and COVID was not on the horizon. How much did that coming up in February and March, you'd been with the Indiana Farm Bureau for a few months at that point. How did that change the way that you had to do your job?
Well, it upended the whole thing, to be quite honest. My plan was right after session to get out and around with our members. I met very few of them when I was still at the State Department of Ag, but really wanted to get out there and make the rounds with folks, meet our members, see their farms, visit their operations, hear their concerns. And that just came to a halt. It was interesting. I spent the first 3 months of my time with Farm Bureau at the State House and the following months at my own house, as many folks did, with their industries and their companies. And so we had to pivot. We had to pivot because it was going to be a hunker down type of situation. And so we had to address what that meant for our members and their needs. Now, of course, it didn't take long for folks to realize that food and ag needed to be an essential industry at the time. And we worked with the governor, lieutenant governor's office to make sure that that was a covered industry at the time. And they knew that intuitively, but we made sure that the details were there as well. One of the things that we had to work on, for instance, was dealing with the packing plants that closed due to COVID outbreaks in those meat processing facilities. And then the problems of the bottlenecks that that created in the supply chain. And even on the production side for the crop folks, dealing with just as one example of another issue we ran into, credentialing for commercial driver's licenses in the ag world,
right.
Being able to get folks in trucks so they can get to the farm to deliver inputs and things like that. So those were a couple of instances.
Yeah, Jeff, that's something that a lot of people haven't. There's just so many facets of industry that COVID has affected that people just don't necessarily think of. When you think of truck drivers and those people hauling, you think, well, you know, that really shouldn't affect them because they're in a truck, they're solitary confinement, maybe other than the truck stop or whatever. And that's all fine, but you have to consider the trucking industry right now, or actually even before COVID, was having a problem finding enough drivers. And then when COVID hit, now you've got to train these drivers. You've got to get them out there on the road with trainers with them, that sort of thing. And with the restrictions and all that, it's very difficult to do. So that's got to be a domino effect and had to have hurt the hemp industry as well as all the industries.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It was not only the shortage of drivers themselves, but then you can't credential new drivers if your government agencies are not open to allow you to do so. And so we had to work with the administration to get the Bureau of Motor Vehicles reopened in a strategic way, safely, mm-hmm. and they mm-hmm. did so to make sure that we could get those credentials. And we worked with folks in the administration to make sure we could get packing plants back open in a safe and timely manner. And so I think some things have bounced back, but there's still some issues that have been highlighted due to all that that we'll be working on this session as well.
Jeff Cummins with the Indiana Farm Bureau. Jeff is the Associate Policy Director. And Jeff, as the Associate Policy Director, do you find that you work more with the legislature or more with the farmers out in the field?
I would say it's a good mix of both. We certainly get our policy priorities, our instructions, directions from the members as a membership organization. And we take those concerns and those interests to the State House and try to advocate for them as best we can. And so it's really kind of a grassroots effort. Our policy process, just so folks know, really starts now. I think I have my first policy development meeting with one of our county farm bureaus next week. And that's where at the county level, through their membership, they identify policy issues important to them. And they'll run the gamut from broadband to environmental issues to pesticide issues to hemp and hemp production and those kinds of things. And so that kind of funnels up as the counties all do that over the winter, spring. That funnels then to another layer of advisory committees, policy advisory committees that we've got that guide us on the policy issues that came up from the counties. And then that goes even further to a resolutions committee. And then ultimately, at the end of the chain, into our policy book. So we get our directives directly from the members in a grassroots fashion. So that way we have, kind of the best, closest information from them to know what to go advocate for. And we do that both at the State House and amongst the agencies. I spend quite a bit of my time with the Indiana Department of Transportation, Indiana Department of Environmental Management, Department of Natural Resources, and of course on the hemp issue, Office of Indiana State Chemists. And we work with them on a whole host of issues, feed, seed, pesticides, and fertilizers, but certainly with the good team there in the seed section on hemp issues and the licensing thereof. So we spend a lot of time with agencies and the State House. And of course, we have a federal affairs member, Bob White, who has been a good friend, I think, to the hemp industry, very supportive. And we appreciate his advocacy on those issues at a federal level.
And Jeff, is there a Farm Bureau chapter or whatever you would call that in every county in Indiana?
We have all 92 counties, and Farm Bureau is over 100 years old. And we're kind of we're strong on the policy advocacy side, but we're also a solutions oriented organization. Most folks probably know us for the property and casualty insurance company that we have, but that didn't come along until later. It was the farmer member side that started at a grassroots level in 1919 and then grew to where it was able to solve other problems for farmer members, including forming the Farm Bureau Co-op, the Property and Casualty Company, and most recently, Indiana Farm Bureau Health Plans. Mm-hmm. We passed a bill last session to give us the legal authority to create health plans for our members, health benefits, and that company, with the help of many others, Tennessee Farm Bureau, who has been doing this for quite some time, that launched in October for open enrollment, and those plans took effect this year, January 1. So we're thrilled that we're able to solve these problems for our members in a whole host of ways, including the policy advocacy side.
And how many members are there in the Indiana Farm Bureau?
We have roughly almost 70,000 of the farmer members. Mm-hmm. And when you count in the insurance customers, you get around 260,000 members in the state of Indiana. But the voting members that set our policy and really that I work for on the farmer member side are 70,000.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned you have chapters in all 92 counties in Indiana. So I assume that, I guess I never thought about it, there are farms in every one of the 92 counties, correct?
That's right.
There is some sort of farming going on.
They all look a little different depending on where you're at. You'll find a lot of the dairy in the top third of the state. You'll find we don't do a whole lot of beef here, but if you were to look for that, it's probably going to be down in the southeast portion. You've got specialty crops, watermelons, cucumbers, peppers, over in the Southwest kind of area, Vincennes and those kinds of places. And of course, the corn, beans, wheat, and hogs all over the state that really make us. And there's even still some farm ground in Marion County, although not a whole lot, but they do a little bit here. And then, one of the things they also do is some of these leafy greens. I've toured facilities that do kind of these microgreens, indoor grows, and there's one in Portage as well. And so, depending on where you're at, you're going to see a variety of our diverse agricultural assets here.
And something else I want that you had mentioned earlier on, a nugget I wanted to pull out. You'd mentioned broadband, and we've heard the governor talk a lot and tout some accomplishments with broadband. In this day and age, 2021, most people, I think, especially suburban people, folks from the city, would just assume that, internet's been around for a couple decades now. You would think everybody's got internet. That really shouldn't be a problem. You can't imagine anybody with dial-up or anything like that anymore. But from what you're seeing out there in the rural areas, is broadband, is that a problem? People having a problem getting internet?
Yes, it still is. It remains a problem. And I'll tell you, it's difficult to ignore the lens of the pandemic when you look at these various issues. Broadband, I think, has transformed into not a rural broadband problem, but a suburban and urban problem as well. They may have the requisite speeds and access in the cities and towns around the state, but when you've got mom and dad potentially working from home, son and daughter maybe learning from home, you quickly run out of bandwidth and you realize the need maybe to increase speeds and access around the whole state. And so I think there's going to be a lot of momentum this legislative session to deal with that issue. One of the things we're advocating is an increase of speeds. The Federal Communications Commission says that you really need to have speeds. Their federal minimum for speeds is a 25 megabit per second download speed and a 3 megabit per second upload speed. Mm-hmm. And right now across many of the rural parts of the state, it's 10 down and 1 up. Mm-hmm. And frankly, you probably really don't have broadband if that's the speed that you're at. So
sure.
We're going to be advocating an increase in speeds. We're going to be advocating for an enhancement in the grant program. We realize the budget constraints that are there. We're not going to go crazy with that, but we do know that ultimately this still does remain somewhat of a funding problem when you think about deployment of infrastructure throughout the state. And so we're over the moon that Governor Holcomb committed his $100 million to the broadband grant program a couple of years ago.
And is that going to the broadband companies or to how does that, without getting into the weeds, this is not something we typically would talk about here, but just
sure.
Out of curiosity, is that going to the companies in order to buy more fiber optic, or how does that work?
Yeah, it could go to a municipality. It could go to an REMC. I can just tell you briefly, without getting too much in the weeds, there's $79 million that have gone out to 41 counties. And so that could be an REMC or a municipality in that county. But yes, it's in 41 locations around the state. And so we hope to see more of that. One other piece, and then feel free to move on from broadband. But
sure.
We're talking about providing those same communities and localities sort of a local development authority so they can raise revenue and do some of their own investments in broadband infrastructure as well. Part of that necessarily includes planning. Purdue has a good program that can assist communities with planning, sort of a needs assessment for broadband. And I think there's going to be a lot of folks trying to assess what their real need is and how to meet it in light of the pandemic. So we'll be talking about speeds, funding and planning forward.
Fantastic. Again, we're speaking with Jeff Cummins from the Indiana Farm Bureau. Jeff is the Associate Policy Director. Let's talk about some of those policies. What are some of the goals, some of the legislative goals for the Indiana Farm Bureau for 2021?
Absolutely. Well, we touched on broadband already. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we're looking at as well is a budget request to get more meat and poultry inspectors in the Board of Animal Health. They lost employees in the prior recession when budget cuts had to be made, and they just haven't recovered to the necessary staffing capacity that they need. And so let me tie this all together again, kind of looking through the lens of the pandemic. We saw that plants were shut down because they had COVID exposure in their facilities with employees, and in some cases took a couple weeks or more to get back up and running. At even just that limited amount of time, and particularly if it happened again, and maybe a few months later there was another shutdown, that began to back up a lot of hogs and a lot of cattle on the farms. Mm-hmm. And so you run into problems there where you've got more animals than probably your, let's say, Department of Environmental Management permit would allow. And you can't get it into the facility because they're shut down. And then you start to see the run on the grocery store shelves. So mm-hmm. it was a real difficult problem, real difficult because the animals were there. They were there. They just couldn't get through the facility to then get to the grocery store.
I see.
So there was a lot of conversation about what do we do there? So there are a few kind of pieces of this that all tie together based on what we saw last year. One, we know that facilities need to expand. There are some that want to. They just don't have the capital to infuse into their own facilities to make that happen. And we were so grateful that the governor's office and lieutenant governor's office committed $4 million from the CARES Act funding they received from the federal government to get to create a matching grant program to get those facilities up to capacity.
And to be clear, Jeff, this was a problem before COVID. This was not caused by COVID in March.
It was exacerbated by COVID, but yes, I think there was a need for capacity at these processing facilities, meat and poultry in particular, well before COVID reared its head. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so it certainly exacerbated the problem of capacity. There were long wait times at some of these facilities. And so the $4 million grant matching program from administered by the Lieutenant Governor Crouch's office is just a godsend to make sure that facilities could have a little bit of that cash infusion they needed. Now, I'm not going to say $4 million solved the whole problem. You could probably spend $4 million to build one facility. Mm-hmm. But it started to give folks a little bit more certainty that they could make these investments and it would be worthwhile.
Did it put more people on the payroll? Did it bring back some of the inspectors?
So I'm not sure it brought back inspectors. And so I'll tie that into the need for inspectors, too. But what it did do, I think, is what it will do once folks really get up and running is spur investment in these processing facilities so they can increase the number of hogs or cattle they can run through their facilities. And that's where you need more inspectors because you can build all the capacity you want mm-hmm. And you can run more cattle and hogs through those facilities. But if you don't have the inspectors to run every day, it doesn't really matter. And so we'll be asking state legislators to give Board of Animal Health some additional funding for meat and poultry inspectors so that when those CARES Act dollars really finally get implemented and these facilities start doing some building and expansion, the inspectors will be there to meet the need.
So with this latest round of stimulus that they've been talking about, is there anything included in there for that, or would this be future funding that you would be seeking?
You know, I think we really haven't seen anything for the processing side out of federal stimulus yet. Maybe they're possible. We've overlooked it, but haven't seen any discussion of additional federal stimulus for processing facility expansion or capacity. Mm-hmm. So I think right now, as it stands, we'll just be kind of tied to the existing CARES Act dollars that we received over the summer. Some of which the state still has to distribute for different reasons and different causes related to COVID-19. So we're probably just talking about the $4 million from those initial CARES Act dollars for now. Mm-hmm. But certainly, you know, President-elect Biden is talking about an additional stimulus package. We'll see what that proposal looks like. Because there's going to be plenty of need in the ag community for that.
And Jeff, did we hit on all of the legislative goals that you wanted to talk about, or are there more?
I've got a couple I'd like to touch on, sure. I'd like to provide kind of an overview of what I think the session will cover, and I can be brief about that.
Oh, but, and that's fine. Take your time.
So one of the things we're doing is a home-based vendors bill. Well, what is a home-based vendor? Well, it kind of is what it sounds like. It's someone that creates, produces, and processes a value-added product of some kind, maybe a sauce or a jelly, a jam, a baked good, an ice cream, a soda from their home or farm, and can sell it direct to consumer from the farm at a roadside stand or a farmer's market. Well, again, through the lens of this pandemic, what we've really seen is that when big facilities go down, there's a need for local food dollars to come in and meet the need that's out there. Mm-hmm. We've seen an increasing, over the years, an increasing consumer demand for local products and an increase in interest from producers in meeting it, both large and small. And so along those lines, we've also seen the need, in order for folks to remain socially distanced and safe, for direct delivery to the home, contactless delivery, whether that's your pizza on a Friday night or your groceries in the middle of the week. And so what we're saying is some of these small value-added producers ought to have the same opportunity. And so this bill will seek to expand the channels of trade for those folks who primarily are selling directly to consumers in those limited capacities right now, farmers markets, roadside stands, or directly off the farm. Mm-hmm. So we'll allow them, the bill as written, will allow them to sell by phone, by mail, or do online ordering, and then have direct delivery to the home. And so for some of your listeners might be familiar with the Indiana Grown program at the Indiana State Department of Ag. I always think about those kinds of folks, maybe somebody doing coffee or snack foods or produce of some kind, honey. We do a lot of honey. And so those are the kinds of things we want to be able to move through those expanded channels of trade. We layer in some guardrails because food safety is key. We don't want it to be the Wild West. And we want to make sure we protect consumer health and the industry's overall reputational health. But that'll be a really neat bill, I think, coming this session for local producers, which, by the way, will include hemp and hemp products that we know are being processed in some ways in that small scale with small value-added producers. And so we hope that hemp producers are able to take advantage of this as well and move their products not just through retail, but maybe online and other capacities as well. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully this even opens the door for additional opportunities at a small level, that folks who want to get into the hemp industry don't feel like they have to be, commercial or large scale in nature. And we hope that this bill will do some of that as well.
Fantastic. What else do we have on the agenda?
Well, one of our foundational issues is uniformity in property tax assessments. And so, for folks, especially I would say some of the indoor hemp growers that have facilities, we have members across the state that are experiencing inconsistencies in assessments of very similar real property features, depending on the county in which they reside. Just as an example, you might classify the land underneath a livestock barn as commercial, and therefore that changes it from an agricultural assessment, and that probably ought not be. And in one county, it might meet the agricultural assessment standards. So we see differences depending on the county you're in between real and personal property and in how it's classified. And that creates an issue for taxpayers, property owners, because then they've got to go and spend their time and money to appeal these subjective assessments. So we'll be working on some things that hopefully find some uniformity in property tax assessments. And hopefully the members of the Midwest Hemp Council will have an interest in that as well.
So would this would be a statewide legislation that you're looking for? Because, people talk about how convenient and how the government is better at a local level. However, anybody that's dealt with a local government in zoning issues, things like that, understands that you might not have a quorum for months, and it could take forever to actually get up in front of a board and or do an appeal, that sort of thing. So sometimes it is more efficient to go to a state level.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And certainly we support local government at all levels in its current structure. But what we do want to see is consistency in the way they do things, particularly on property tax assessments. So it's not so much about taking away any kind of authority, but rather saying we need uniformity in the way the standards are supposed to be met, and that it shouldn't be open to interpretation. Mm-hmm. A livestock mm-hmm. barn shouldn't be commercial in one county and agricultural in another.
Sure.
Similar to perhaps an indoor hemp grow, shouldn't be commercial in one county and agricultural in another. And so this is really about saying locals, do your jobs. We certainly appreciate and want you to do them. We just like them. We'd like not have to guess at the outcome.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, that would make sense. Yes, you should not be penalized for where you live doing the same thing as somebody that might be 20 feet across the border, county border.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And go ahead, Jeff.
Well, just some other issues that I think I'll move off of our priorities. I've kind of touched on those, but I think, this session will be dominated by, of course, the budget discussion. Times are tight. There's been a budget shortfall, and lawmakers will have a difficult time, I think, making sure they balance the budget, which is one of their goals, without having to raise taxes. So it's just going to be kind of a difficult and delicate conversation on the budget, which necessarily includes education funding. I know education is going to be a big priority. We want those folks, and for our members, the rural schools, to have fair and equitable funding as they go into this as well. And then also COVID-19 liability protection. You can always kind of tell where the legislature's priorities are by how they number their bills. And so on COVID-19 liability, that one's been filed as Senate Bill 1. And in the House side, it's been filed as House Bill 1002. Now, that's still a low number, even though it sounds high, because they start their bills at 1001.
Okay. What is 1001?
The budget will be 1001.
Oh, okay.
It's typically the number one prior. So budget will be 1001, civil liability protection for healthcare and other industries will be 1002 on the House side. So you can tell what they're focused on.
Civil liability. Now, we've heard a lot about that comes across the news quite a bit, but nobody ever talks about it in depth. And we don't need to go in depth, but if you would, go ahead and just define what that means and who that would protect what would be the purpose of that?
Yeah, the long and short is that it will limit lawsuit exposure for healthcare providers, and I have I've got to get more in depth in the bill, but I know there's more in there that may provide protection for schools and businesses as well. But the long and short is that anybody that could be susceptible to a lawsuit or a class action suit of some kind due to what someone might argue would be negligence, whether true or not, or, you know, a failure to do something, whether true or not,
sure,
it would protect them from those lawsuits related to trying to respond to accommodate the problems associated with COVID-19. So that's the long and short. It will limit the lawsuit exposure that many of these healthcare providers and other companies face.
And that could obviously also include farmers or anybody that owns a business that has employees or has customers. They could turn around and try to point a finger. And again, winning a lawsuit isn't everything. You have to actually win a lawsuit, and that will financially or can financially put a lot of people out of business.
That's exactly right. Victory in the lawsuit can be very expensive, maybe even more expensive sometimes than defeat.
Well, but, usually the only people that win are the attorneys in those situations.
Yeah, exactly right. So hopefully this provides the protection that's needed, because we don't want businesses to be stymied, healthcare providers to be stymied in trying to respond to this crisis and trying to open back up the economy for fear of being sued.
And how long does this session last, Jeff?
So they just gaveled in on January the 4th, this Monday. So we are in week one of the General Assembly. And by statute, they're required to wrap up business by April 29th. And so, you know, I think that the legislature is prepared for some potential stops and starts, not necessarily even associated with one member of the legislature getting COVID-19, but perhaps they're merely a close contact to someone who does have it, and they have to quarantine for 10 days or so, or 14. So I think they're prepared. Speaker of the House, Todd Houston from Fishers, was very clear in an article I saw that said, we ought to not fool ourselves. This could be a session that has disruptions. And so I think they're prepared for a start-stop kind of session. Which means they may have to call themselves in. I should say the governor may have to call them in, because he's currently the only one that has the authority to call a special session. But they may have to call a special session for May if they haven't wrapped up their business. So they could go long, or if the disruptions become too problematic, they could maybe just let some less important bills die. And there are a lot out there that are important, but they could just let some things die in order to wrap up business more quickly. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple things I think we'll still be looking at to get done in April. I think they're going to, my understanding is they get U.S. Census data April 1st. And this is the year after the decennial year where we take the census, where they have to do redistricting. And so they will redistrict the House maps, the Senate maps, and the congressional maps as well. And if that data comes late, it may push the session out a little longer. I also think they'll want to see the April budget forecast. And that may be something that pushes things out a little longer, too. So April 29th by statute, but the governor can always call a special session if there's still more work to be done.
Well, this governor not really known for calling special sessions. I think a lot of people a little upset about that over the last few months, that maybe there should have been one called for other purposes. But with the possible Well, again, we have no idea what's going on in the federal government as far as maybe more stimulus coming out in the next couple of months. Obviously, just this week, we looks like we finally settled everything politically as far as who's holding the House, who's holding the Senate, who the right. president is going to be. So could that possibly, I mean, if there's more stimulus coming, if that happens, say, February, March, could that change the budget for Indiana if they're thrown more money? Or would that have no effect right now on this session?
You know, it's a good question because it very well could change in light of the political change in the Trump administration. And when Republicans were in control of the Senate, it looked like they were very opposed to sending money to shore up state and local budgets. That was a priority for Democrats. They knew that budget shortfalls occurred at that level. But the Republicans said this really ought to go to people, to businesses, to keep people employed, to farmers and other essential health care providers, hospitals and others, but not so much to state and local budgets. So it's possible now that leadership has changed, that there could be some funding. If there's another stimulus bill, that there could be funding that would include the ability for states to use it to shore up budgets.
And if the federal government decides to hand more money to the states, is that going to change the budget process going on midstream? Would they have to completely tear it up and start over again?
It depends. You know, if it's a situation where it's a pot of money and it and state and local budgetary gap filling is merely one of the options for which they can use it, they may still decide to put that away and try to pass as tight a budget as they can and then use that for other expenses. Now, I can't read their minds, and this is a lot of speculation as to what might happen, but I can imagine that they will want to evaluate all the options of need for any potential future federal stimulus before filling gaps in the state's own budget.
And there's also some more legislation, of course, coming down the pike for hemp growers and the hemp industry out there as well.
Well, I look forward to working on some of the hemp bills. You know, you allowed me latitude to talk about some of the other things we're working on and that we're keeping an eye on. But I'm excited to work on the hemp legislation that'll be out there. Our members have taken a strong market-oriented stand in support of hemp. They'd like it to be treated as any other crop. They want it to be done in a free market atmosphere where the rights of Indiana farmers who desire to produce it are respected. And so they understand the need for regulation and oversight, but you know, as technology improves and we learn more about the crops through research, and particularly on the technology side for law enforcement, we hope to see a more market-based approach to this crop where, you know, maybe there's some more flexibility on things like a THC level, not getting mm-hmm. carried away, but a little mm-hmm. more flexibility. Mm-hmm. So we're not having to mow under or burn crops that maybe aren't as compliant because they're fairly stringent standards. And I think in some cases, a little arbitrary for that THC level. So our members want this to be as market-oriented as possible. We're excited about some of the technology we've been hearing about that law enforcement could use to make those distinctions more quickly between hemp and marijuana so they can do their jobs effectively. And I think we're excited to support the Midwest Hemp Council and their efforts this session.
All right, Jeff, how can folks get in touch with you or the Indiana Farm Bureau with questions, comments, and how can they get just more information about the organization?
Well, our website is chock full of that information. It's got all of the information for staff, including our policy team here with contact information. But I can be reached at jcummins@infb.org, jcummins@infb.org. Always happy to talk to members of Midwest Hemp Council and your listeners on any questions they might have. And we'll certainly stay in touch with you and your folks as this session moves forward. And we collaborate on a number of issues. And keep your listeners updated as to what's going on at the State House.
And you have certainly kept us updated today. We certainly do appreciate that, Jeff. And I hope we can get you back on the program here soon and get some more updates.
We'd love to do that, Jason. Thank you, and thank you again.
All right, absolutely. We will talk to you soon, sir.
Take care.
And that's going to do it for our show this week. This week's podcast is brought to you by Lewis Organics and owners Jason and Rachel Kidwell. You can find them on Facebook under Lewis Organics. If you'd like more information about the Midwest Hemp Council, please go to our website, MidwestHempCouncil.com, and find out how you can get involved, volunteer, and become a member. Thanks again for tuning in, and remember to tell a friend about the Midwest Hemp Council weekly podcast. I'm your host, Jason Dozier, and we'll see you next time. So long, everybody.